Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, how's it going? This is Ben, this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for joining me for episode 68, for which my guest is the brilliant Anastasia Taylor-Lind. Before I introduce Anastasia properly, the usual reminders are in order, I think. If you're a regular listener, please leave a review on iTunes if you haven't done so already. Many thanks for those of you who have left one, which I appreciate very much. There are some really lovely comments on there which genuinely warm the cockles of my heart, so thank you. If you'd like to support the ongoing production of A Small Voice, please consider becoming a patron by signing up for a very small recurring monthly donation of roughly the cost of an overpriced cup of coffee. Special thanks also to those of you who have done that. What else? Christopher Anderson of Magnum Photos fame was in town for a flying visit recently, and I'm glad to say he very graciously agreed to have a chat with me while he was here, so Christopher will be coming soon. Also had a very interesting talk with legendary photojournalist turned legendary photography course leader Paul Lowe. We covered a lot of ground, and that's going to go out in two parts, such was our mutual verbosity. I couldn't be happier about that. It was great stuff from Paul. Very good to talk to him. Watch this space, of course. Back to the present. Anastasia Taylor-Lind is an English/Swedish photographer who for the past decade has worked for leading editorial publications all over the world on issues relating to women, population and war. She's a Harvard Nieman Fellow and recently finished a year of research at the university on war and how we tell stories about modern conflict. Anastasia is also currently a Logan Fellow at the Carey Institute for Global Good, where she is working on a book about the visual representation of contemporary warfare and the photojournalists who cover it. She's also a TED Fellow. Anastasia has written about her experiences as a photojournalist for the New York Times, Time Lightbox, Nieman Reports and National Geographic. As a photographic storyteller, her focus has been on long-form narrative reportage for monthly magazines. She is a National Geographic magazine contributor, and her other clients include Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, Time, The New York Times, Sunday Times, Telegraph and Guardian. Her first book, Maiden, Portraits from the Black Square, which documents the 2014 Ukrainian uprising in Kiev, was published by Ghost Books the same year. Anastasia's work has been exhibited internationally in spaces such as the Saatchi Gallery, the Frontline Club and the National Portrait Gallery in London, Side Gallery in Newcastle, Fovea Exhibitions in New York, Picto Gallery in Toronto and the New Mexico Museum of Modern Art in Santa Fe. A wide variety of organisations have recognised and supported her projects through awards such as the POYI, Sony World Photography Awards, Royal Photographic Society bursaries and the FNAC grant at Visa pour l'Image. Anastasia has a BA degree in documentary photography from the University of Wales and an MA from the London College of Communication. She's currently regularly engaged with education, teaching at leading universities in Europe and the USA, including at MIT, Harvard and Columbia University. It's not a bad CV from someone for whom school was entirely voluntary, is it? She's a woman of considerable talents and an excellent photographer. I really enjoyed this chat with Anastasia Taylor-Lind. You've been in the States for a while, based there, you know, on the East Coast somewhere.
Yeah, I was in Boston for a year and then New York, or upstate New York, right, for a year. Yeah.
So what's brought you back to London?
My dad died and he was...
Oh yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. So yeah, I want to be at home. Right. He died this summer. He was sick, so I hadn't intended to move back, but I'm here now.
Yeah, one of those unexpected eventualities that... changes things.
It does. Big way.
I saw that that note of his that you put on Instagram, which was really lovely, you know.
I mean, I keep finding them. I have a whole series.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that he must have been a good dad. You know, you don't need too much information to come to a conclusion, you know, about someone's qualities. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit, I think. I'd love to find out a little bit more about your kind of early years. But recently, what have you been up to? Because you've been to Bangladesh to cover the Rohingya refugee situation. Tell me a little bit about what you've been up to there and, you know, how it kind of came about.
I got back from Bangladesh 3 or 4 days ago. I was there for almost a month on an assignment for Human Rights Watch. So I was part of team of researchers who were, or a part of a research team who were investigating crimes against humanity being committed against the Rohingya population inside Burma. So I was working with the team to photograph the situation in the refugee camps across the border in Bangladesh, but also to make a series of portraits of massacre survivors. Basically, the team, the researchers in the team would interview and take eyewitness accounts of atrocities that had been committed inside Burma, and I'd make portraits of the people who we collected those testimonies from.
Have you worked with Human Rights Watch before? Have you got a relationship with them, or was this
was the first time working for Human Rights Watch?
Yeah, so they obviously they are familiar with your work.
I was working with a researcher who's the director of emergencies at Human Rights Watch called Peter Bookhart, and we met a few years ago when we taught a workshop together at Visa Paul Image in Perpignan.
Have you come across Corinne Dufka?
No, but that name rings a bell. But
I think she works for them. She used to, but she was back in the day. She was, a photojournalist herself, and she gave it all up to go and do something more useful, one might argue.
That makes sense.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, ultimately, if you are coming at it from that point of view, then it's sort of a logical step in a way. But she was a magnificent photojournalist, and one of the best. So how did you find the situation? Was it worse than you expected it to be? Because it seems to me that this hasn't had a lot of media attention in the way that these crises sometimes do. I mean, given the scale of atrocities that are being committed, I wasn't really aware of it until I started looking at what you've been up to.
I don't feel like much of an expert on the media and media coverage at the moment. So I don't really know how to respond to that question. When we say the media, am I looking at what people are posting, the articles and the links to journalistic pieces that people are posting on my Facebook? Well, I'm friends with lots of people who are covering the Rohingya crisis. Most of my friends are worldly engaged, politically active people. So when I look at my social media feeds, the Rohingya crisis is well covered. I don't read newspapers anymore, really. Mm. I don't buy them. So I'm not really sure if I were to go out for a week and buy the newspapers in England, all of them, what I would find there in terms of the coverage of the Rohingya crisis. And then if I were to do that in France and America. So I don't really have a good, it's not that I'm being cautious. It's like, I really don't have a good sense of what stories are being told and which ones aren't. And that's partly because I'm becoming more aware of falling into the trap of kind of hearsay, some things are well covered, some things are not. And I don't really have any empirical research that looks at that, so I don't know. But also because I've been away from the photojournalism industry for 2.5 years. So I'm not really, I don't feel very connected or very, like I've really got my finger on the pulse of what's going on.
Mm. I was going to ask you whether you sort of consider yourself to be a photojournalist.
Yeah, I do. Right. I am. I mean, I make journalistic pictures. I photograph things that are real. I photograph things that are happening today, in the world that I live in. So yeah, I'm a photojournalist.
Uh-huh. So tell me a little bit about what you sort of discovered when you got to Bangladesh.
I've never covered anything like that before. I've never been in an emergency situation where so many people have been forcibly displaced so quickly. So this military operation against the Rohingya population began the 25th of August, and now there are more than 500,000 Rohingya displaced inside Bangladesh. So there is nothing there for them. They are literally cutting their way with spades and creating platforms or steps on the side of hills, deforested hills, and building bamboo, but building makeshift structures, tents from bamboo and plastic. I've never worked in a place like that before. I've been in refugee camps in the Middle East and in other places, but formal refugee camps that are controlled and governed and, you know, where there's order from the UNHCR or something like that. But there was just, there's just literally 500,000 people.
Yeah. And also you're coming across some pretty horrific stories about the most appalling crimes being committed against children and God knows what else. How do you respond to that kind of thing? Are you quite good at dealing with that stuff?
I don't know how to answer that. No, just let me think. Well, these things happen, don't they? They're happening now. They've happened before. They've always happened. These horrific violence and persecutions and crimes people commit against each other. So I can say I know that these things happen. I know that they still happen. I don't believe that there is anything such as pure evil. I don't believe that some people are bad and some people are good. Even the perpetrators of unbearable, unspeakable, unbelievable crimes came into this world as small, innocent babies. And I think about the way we tell stories about very extreme violence and about how we like to tell stories about the good guys and the bad guys. And it's a very easy and good and nice way to package everything up so that we can have a full stop at the end or the end at the end of our story. And so I think about the way we tell stories about the Nazis, their pure evil, if you like, the way we tell stories about ISIS, that gives us that gives us permission to not really have to think about it too much. They're just bad, you know, it's just awful. And so when I'm hearing stories like this, I'm also thinking, about the perpetrators of those crimes too. This isn't something that I can resolve in the photographs that I've made in Bangladesh. This isn't probably anything that can be resolved with photography. But when it comes to hearing stories of mass atrocities again, you know, that are being committed today, as they have been in other genocides, I think about those things and our responsibility as storytellers to try and talk about mass violence in a way that is more nuanced and more complicated. I don't have a resolution for that, but this is what I'm thinking about in the last few days since I returned, and that's how I want to respond to your question. You know, that's my gut instinct of these are the things, you know.
Did you have a brief from Human Rights Watch? I mean, in terms of how you were going to shoot it, was it up to you, or did they have a different? Because I don't know whether these images are going to are sort of testimony, as it were, or whether they're going to be published or something. What's going to happen with them?
So I was working really closely with the Human Rights Watch team, with Peter Burkhardt and Richard Weir, and then and some of the other Human Rights Watch staff. So the investigation that they're implementing is being conducted very close, you know, like we're working together as a team. So as the photographer and a videographer, there was the photographer, the videographer, and two researchers. So Human Rights Watch are compiling reports on what's happening there. My pictures will be used to accompany these reports to provide visuals, I mean, what visuals we can to illustrate what they're talking about. I mean, the first thing is, of course, that I can't photograph the extreme violence that's being committed against people. And so I'm meeting people a week after these things have happened. No one is able to photograph inside Rakhine State. It's impossible to reach there. There are sometimes some sort of propaganda tours by the Burmese government, but as a photographer, it's not physically possible for me to photograph that violence, to picture it, to depict it. So it is what it is, you know. Photography is, of course, a limiting medium, but I'm trying, I'm showing what there is to see, what I can have access to. So I'm making portraits. And sometimes it's the scars of that violence is visible physically in the portraits. I photograph people with bullet holes in their bodies and burns and machete wields on their heads. And I photographed a woman who'd had her throat cut. But of course, there are many things that you can't see in the photographs. The systematic rape of women and the murdering of their babies. I can't picture that. Human Rights Watch are also using satellite imagery of the now, as of today, 288 Rohingya villages that have been razed to the ground. So that's one way to picture what's happening there. But in terms of my brief, I mean, Peter hired me because he trusts me as a photographer, and it's very much a collaboration between, you know, with their research and with my photographs. So we worked very closely and shared research, interviews and photographs every day, talked about sort of the creative process and how to approach, you know, the semantics of photography, as it were. And so portraits, and in kind of like a, we talked about the, you know, this 500,000 people, Peter and I, and how we can and to try and pick individuals from that mass of numbers, that massive, you know, that sea of people and representation.
Yeah, to sort of humanize the situation, as it were.
And that's why Peter thought that portraits would be the best approach.
I mean, I'm wondering whether one of the reasons he chose you is because he'd seen your stuff from Maiden Square.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. And I think we're going to get onto that, and I'd like to talk about that project, which you made a book from, and that was in the Ukraine. But before we get into that, you're quite an advocate of using social media as well, in terms of, you know, that now being another medium through which you can get the story into, you know, onto people's computer screens or whatever. When did you first start doing that, or thinking that that would, or was it just a very obvious and kind of natural thing for you to do? I think probably maybe it was the Ukraine thing.
Well, I bought an iPhone because of the camera. And once I had that, I think I started using Instagram. My mum was the first person I knew who had an iPhone. She had the Hipstamatic app.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
That was really cool. In 2009, she came to visit me in Damascus, where I was living at that time. And she brought her new iPhone with the Hipstamatic app and took pictures of her visit and holiday with me in Syria. It's another platform. I didn't know. I mean, I didn't have any great foresight. I was just like, okay, there's another way to share pictures. Let's play with it a bit, or let's try it out. But I was pretty sure from the beginning that the pictures, the content should be different for social media. That, it, you know, if you're working for a magazine, if you're making pictures and you know it's going to be a book, if you are trying to make a social media project, like the pictures that you make and the ideas that you develop ought to be different. So, yeah, in Ukraine, I really was when I really took, you know, quite seriously the social media sort of element of my work about the revolution and the war, and tried to create stories specifically for that medium and that way of reaching people. But not every project, you know, it's just another thing.
It's another
way of reaching people, and it's another, I mean, yeah, I'm trying to think about it. So, I mean, social media is so much part of our lives now, of my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
of course.
But
mostly, you know, we're sharing pictures of cats and meals, to use a cliche. And But the idea that it could also be useful in a really kind of serious or, you know, journalistic way is perhaps not something that, obviously not something that would have necessarily been anticipated.
I don't mind cats and meals.
No, I'm not. Do you know what I mean? I'm not dissing cats and meals. That's fine. It's all cool. No, of course.
But is there something as well, right? And yeah. Selfies and I think there's interesting stuff to learn from all of that. And I sometimes post pictures of my dinner.
Yeah, I put stuff of my kid up there. You know, I mean, who cares about my kid, right? But you know, I mean, anyway. Well, let's sort of go back a bit, really. I suppose, and sort of, I want to kind of figure out how you kind of got to here. So you had a kind of very unusual upbringing in a way. Tell me a little bit about that. What are your memories of childhood? Because you had a kind of a gypsy existence. Tell me about it.
I was born on the road in the Cotswolds in 1981. My parents had bought a job lot of a Botop wagon, a horse, her name was Blue, and a harness from a gypsy camp in Hackney. And they'd set out to travel, the West Country of the UK. So we were horse-drawn for the first few years of my life, and then we eventually bought a field and settled in caravans and trailers, two trailers, in Devon on the edge of Exmoor. So I grew up without electricity or running water or television or newspapers or magazines or you know, we had radio and books and poetry, so less influence from popular culture, I suppose.
But did they come from that background, or were they just kind of, you know, had they just been influenced by kind of hippiedom and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so my dad grew up in the 60s, and his life story was really one about rejecting the expectations that his family and his society put on him. You know, his entire youth was dedicated to fucking the system and finding himself and not being who other people wanted him to be, you know? So growing up in East London in a working class family, being expected to take an apprenticeship, to learn a trade, to, you know, just this ordinary kind of, you know, this is who you are, this is what you should do, this is what you ought to do. And so when my parents had kids, they really didn't want that for us. They wanted us to be able to be who we were going to become, not who they wanted us to be. So the childhood that I had was very much based around that. Like, for example, when I was born, my parents called me Anastasia, and they didn't give me a surname because they saw a surname as also a symbol of that sort of oppression or that expectation. They didn't want me to grow up with the weight of the name of and the expectations of my family and my society. So they wanted me to be free, you know, this idealistic kind of approach to because they had had to. Because my dad had had to fight so much to be himself, you know, he always felt that he was different and that wasn't allowed. So, you know, and school was optional for me. For example, my dad always said, if you want to go to school, you can go to school. If you don't want to go, you don't have to. It's up to you. And so I went to Montessori school a couple of days a week, and I started when I was 9. I said, okay, I want to go to school now, real school, where you have a uniform, like a primary school, Church of England primary school. So I went there. And then, of course, there was a period when I was 13 or 14 when I didn't want to go to school anymore, and I didn't.
Great. So, yeah. Well, it obviously didn't seem to have too much of a detrimental effect on your education.
I'm not very good at spelling. And my handwriting's terrible.
You know, as a kind of, what are you, a Harvard Nyman fellow and a bunch of other things. You know, I think that that's probably evidence enough. And what about your siblings? Did they have a similar experience?
I have a younger brother. He is a sound engineer. He lives just down the road in Hoxton.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So also sort of creative type.
So, I'm wondering about this, the kind of values that I guess you must have to some extent inherited, unless you know, I guess went the other way and just rejected
Well, that happened at some point as well.
So you what? You were drawn to convention and conforming at some point. That was interesting. But I mean, how has that influenced you as a photographer, do you think?
Well, it allowed me to believe that I could be a photojournalist. I think I was 16 when I came home and told my parents, I've decided I'm going to be a war photographer.
Right.
There was that specifically before I found a book by Don McCullen. And I thought, yeah, that's the job for me.
Okay, so that was what made you come to that?
The first photojournalistic pictures I saw was Don McCullen's book about Vietnam. Yeah. The first time I'd seen photojournalism, I didn't even know it existed. I didn't know that wars looked like that. I knew what they were like because I had read the great war poets as a child. So I knew war described, but I didn't know what it looked like.
Mm.
And I didn't know that there was someone whose job it could be to stand there and to photograph those things. And I wanted to see it for myself. So I think I also, since I was a teenager and I was just, you know, becoming socially aware, you know, for the first time about the injustices in the world and trying to find my place and in trying to do something good with my life, you know, in a very naive, idealistic teenage way. And I think I imagined that photography might be a solution to violence. In my naivety, I had assumed that these great atrocities and violence were committed against people because nobody knew about them, because I didn't know about them. So when I saw the pictures, I thought, maybe if you just had to photograph all these terrible things happening, then they would stop because people would know. Like, it didn't cross my mind for a minute that there would be a structure in place in our world that not only allowed these things to happen, but actually perpetrated for them to happen.
Mm.
It just seemed so incomprehensible to me that if people could just see pictures of wars, then they wouldn't happen, because who the fuck would condone that, you know?
Yeah.
Who would work for warmongering? Not even turn a blind eye, but who would work for it? Didn't make sense to me.
But you had a very sort of visceral, kind of pretty kind of instant reaction to seeing this McCullen book, that you, to the point where you were like, oh, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
And how did your parents respond to that? You obviously remember the conversation more or less.
Yeah. No, both my parents have been were really supportive of my career choice. They always have been.
Yeah.
So I didn't know till like in the last few years ago, but my mum wanted to be a journalist when she was younger. She became a dancer and then a psychotherapist.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. But
So she could, relate to that immediately.
And I also knew that I wanted to keep having a lifestyle that involved traveling and moving and being free and meeting new people and existing outside of the confines of this, you know, of this, what I had been taught was quite an oppressive conventional society.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking that must have stood you in good stead, because, you know, obviously, you know, you've lived in lots of different places. You know, that capacity that you have as a photographer to just assimilate and relate to people as well, obviously. You know, that I guess were the things that you learned pretty young. I think you're saying there's always drinking tea with strangers and pretty good definition of what photography is to some extent.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, my parents had traveled a lot. But they were always skint, always. And I hated that. I hated being aware of money and how much, you know, food cost and making money last for the week and, you know, that sort of stuff. And so I also saw photography as a solution to this problem, because I thought, I want to travel and I want to meet people and I want to experience the world as fully and deeply as is possible, but I'm not wealthy. So how am I going to do that? And so photography was my ticket to it. I thought, okay, well, if someone pays me to do it, then I'll be able to.
It seemed quite a tender age to be figuring some of these things out. I don't know, maybe it isn't.
Have you spent any time with teenage girls recently?
Not recently, no. I've got a couple of nieces who are, heading for teendom, but they're not quite there yet. They're at the early stages of that. But in about 3 years, I'll be able to say yes.
Late nights, sitting around drinking tea, listening to music, trying to find your place in the world, figure out how you're going to engage with the world. It's kind of a magic time. And
yeah, I think maybe girls are much more reflective at that age in life than boys are. But you've kind of taken an interest in girls in general in your work, I think, to some extent, haven't you?
It's interesting. I'm not really sure now when I try and analyze it if that interest was there naturally or if it was put on me. When I first graduated and started trawling my very limited portfolio around to magazines and meeting editors and asking other photographers for advice, I would kind of often be told, yeah, there's something in your work and you're a woman, so you could photograph women's issues. And I was always really just interested in photographing war. I mean, I can explain that later as well. But I feel that in hindsight, although I didn't realize it at the time, my interest was pushed in a direction from where it lay naturally because other people were influenced by my gender. I'm not so sure. I've seen my male colleagues and the dear friends that I grew up with have the same meetings and not be told, oh, this is very interesting. And of course, you're a young man, so you could focus particularly on young men. So I wonder if that's also sexism.
Yeah, I think undoubtedly. And some of these things are so sort of subconscious and insidious that, you know, one doesn't even, you know, you barely notice it yourself kind of thing until, you know, perhaps on reflection later on, you think back and go,
strange advice. Why should I? And I wonder, I mean, if I think about it very critically, I wonder if the message there is like, yeah, we can have more people like you in photojournalism as long as you stick to photographing women.
That's a sort of patriarchal, you know, sort of slightly, you know, maybe we're moving away from that, hopefully, to some extent. And I guess I don't know if there are more women, you know, on the kind of picture editor side of the equation now. I'm sure there must be, to some extent.
There is no evidence to support that there are more women in the photography industry or that those numbers are increasing. And what really matters is women being in power in our industry at the top of the food chain. And there are almost none.
Right.
And it's not just photography, but the problem is there and it's not necessarily improving. It's very interesting to observe the questions that people ask me about my gender, about being a woman photographer. It's interesting to think about the advice that I was given when I was younger. I also find it interesting to the briefs I'm given as a photographer, or, you know, I will of course often be called and said, you know, we've got this story and we want you to go because you're a woman and it involves getting access to somewhere that only women can go. And that is of course sometimes true, but it's often cited as a reason for having more women in photography, you know, like, or even sometimes people say to me, but yeah, you know, of course, because, you know, it's actually much easier being a woman, isn't it? Like in the Middle East, you can get to places that men can't. And there's focus on that in conversations when actually for the most part, it's not easier being a woman. It's much fucking harder being a woman than it is being a man in life. I mean, you're challenged with many more things, but also as a photographer and also in terms of access. Like the streets belong to men. I never feel comfortable or at home on the street in a way that I know I might if I was a man. There are so many
absolutely
layers to that.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, something we talk about a lot on the podcast, and you know, I've written about it, and you know, it's very much kind of on the agenda. And it's always interesting to hear, you know, kind of testimony from all the women photographers I'm talking to. And then there's also that thing which I've referred to it before, but you know, Lindsay Addario has always said that, you know, also because, you know, you feel a disproportionate need to prove yourself, to not seem weak, and not seem, you know, vulnerable, that actually you end up taking stupid risks that, you know, that you actually wouldn't otherwise take, because you're trying to compensate for the fact that you're the woman surrounded by a bunch of blokes, regardless of what their, you know, their personal views are. And you mentioned an interesting example of being with a friend in Ukraine and heading to a dodgy situation. Tell me a little bit about that. Because
friend Alvaro.
Yeah.
Actually, we misremembered that after I wrote it. Sorry, I just have to remember now what. So I was with Alvaro and.
Shall I tell you what I read?
Yeah, because actually what I wrote is not really, right. It's not that it's not true, but I went back and interviewed recently Alyssa and Alvaro, and their memory of the situation is very different. So it's actually interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just haven't written that up yet, and so I can't really get it straight in my mind. But it's a bit more complicated than I thought it was in the beginning.
I mean, the essence of the story was that you were with him in the back of a car on the way to, you know, some a dangerous situation where there was fighting or whatever. I can't remember the specifics of it, but you know, you were heading into danger, and you know, he said you turn white as a sheet as you kind of got to the last checkpoint, and he said, do you want to turn back, you know? And you were like, no. And he said, the only rule is you have to be honest with me. And so I guess you then said, well, yeah, actually, I'm scared shitless. And you did turn back.
Yeah. And it's funny because Alyssa, my friend who was with us, remembers that it was Alvaro who said we should turn back.
Oh, really?
Whereas I thought it was me. So
that is interesting.
Yeah. But Alvaro is a good friend and we're going to work together again soon, I hope. He's somebody I like traveling with. And I mean, this is just growing up, isn't it? When you're 22, it doesn't cross your mind for a second that you might actually die.
No.
You know, so I think this is less gendered perhaps, but more just about growing up and living.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the kind of interesting point of the story was that whoever made that call, you know, it was a damn good one, because who, you know, if it was instinctive or whatever, but I think, you know, it later became apparent that it would have been an incredibly inadvisable trip to make in terms of the amount of danger that you would have been putting yourselves in.
Most trips that photojournalists make in places like that are ill-advisable. And that's really, I suppose, where the decision in terms of risk happens. It's like once you cross the border to Libya or into the Donetsk People's Republic or wherever you're talking about, once you've made that decision to go, you've already taken a huge risk or surrendered to that risk.
Yeah.
Just going, you know, the level of risk that, I mean, I don't just mean in covering conflict, I just mean in general, the way of living is just so different to normal. I mean, I say that now because I've spent 2 years trying to be normal, living with normal people in a normal place, and not traveling and not moving and not making pictures. And now I realize, coming back to photography, like the level of risk is just much higher than most people in the Western world, in the society that I come from, are used to.
Yeah, of course. But it's always a calculation. And I think, I suppose, you know, one's experience is what comes into, one's instinct and one's experience is what comes into play there, because, you know, that like, it's a fine line between acceptable risk and fuck that, I'm just not going to do that, you know. And that, I guess, that can potentially save your life, having that, you know, having that judgment, you know, exactly in the right place, as it were.
But you never know where your judgment, I mean, like,
no, of course not. I mean, I'm talking in general.
I think, like, the real, when you really grow up, you just say, okay, I'm not going at all.
Yeah, maybe. Well, a lot of people do finally come to that decision.
They die.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, what was your first big kind of foreign for an adventure then in photography after you'd finished all your various courses? Because you did a degree and then an MA here in the UK. And then what was your kind of, where did you head to?
The first time I made my own project overseas was when I was studying photography in Newport. I was in the summer before my second and third year. So when I was a student, I went to Kurdistan in northern Iraq. I was 22. It was 2003. The second coalition invasion had just taken place. And I went and embedded myself with a small unit of Peshmerga women soldiers at a base outside of Sulaymaniyah, who were manning a checkpoint and at a big military base. And I spent a month living with them and photographing them. So that was the first time.
Yeah, and you ended up with an iconic image from that story. One might say, I think it would be a valid description, because I think you won an award, didn't you? And it was David Bailey who sort of pointed that out. How did that come over? Did you was that all a big shock to you or a big surprise to you?
I was still learning. I am still learning how to tell pictures. How to tell stories through pictures. So there were lots of holes in my storytelling, but there was this one picture, a portrait of a woman holding her Kalashnikov, manning this checkpoint that I was staying at, and I entered it in a competition. In the portrait category of competition, I'd entered. Do you remember there was the Observer Hodge Award? Yeah, I got like a runner-up in that for another project. But I was just like becoming aware of photography contests and stuff. But anyway, the long and short of it is that I won the main prize and I got £5,000, which I had no money at all. So that and I got an assignment for the Guardian Weekend magazine, and I went back to Kurdistan and I photographed the women in the PKK guerrilla army. So it was like that one lucky break that got me on my way, because of the money and because of the assignment. Because I had spent all of my money on that trip to Iraq. I worked in the council tax office in Qumran over the summer, and I sold my car. And I borrowed £1,000 off my nan and I went to Kurdistan. So I had no money, and film costs money. It wasn't,
I
needed
of course.
To pay my rent and buy film and buy tickets to places and stuff. So that was my one big lucky break.
This thing that I guess we've sort of already alluded to, which is this interest in women in segregated environments, I think that's the term that you use. Was that, I guess that was the beginning, was that the beginnings of that interest doing the Peshmerga?
When I think about it now, I'm not so sure how much of it was my idea and how much of it was other people's ideas, that I should photograph those things. But in any case, I was in the University Air Squadron of the RAF. So I was starting to become aware of this gender inequality for the first time as a young woman from my own experience. Women are not allowed to fight on the front line. So when I heard about the Peshmerga women who were supporting the coalition forces from the north in the fight against Saddam Hussein, I was kind of impressed. As a young woman, I was like, God, I want to meet them, because here I was with my own limited experience of the sort of military environment and structure while I was at university, and finding and encountering this sexism and inequality for the first time. So when I heard about, again, very naive and simple, and that's the wondrous thing about photography, is you can just think, where do I want to go and who do I want to meet? And I wanted to meet those women who were doing something that I wasn't allowed to do. I'm a pacifist, but I had to learn to be one. I wasn't then. I wouldn't be a member of an armed forces in any way now. That was my rebellion against my parents.
Right.
The big fuck you. I'm going to be conventional.
Okay. Well, you mentioned earlier, you know, you kind of put a bookmark in it, but you're going to talk about your desire to photograph war. Mm-hmm. What were you going to say about that?
Well, this comes, I think this also is related to patriarchy. And the way we revere the experience of war in our storytelling and popular culture and poetry and books, children's books, children's songs, the history I learned in primary school, the way we hold the experience of being at war and testing yourself as the epitome of masculinity and manhood, I really wanted to be like a man. You mentioned earlier a bit, you know, like about the macho culture in photojournalism. And yes, there is a pressure, internal, external, on women who do work in this industry to behave in a more masculine way. We admire more masculine traits in photojournalism. And it's interesting as well that in photojournalism, we hold the war photograph as the epitome of the photojournalistic experience, or the epitome of, like, if we were to choose one situation. Does that make sense? Mm. I don't quite know how to articulate it, and it's things that I'm working through in my mind, and it can change as well. But there's something in revering war so much, and revering the people who tell war stories. And I was influenced by that, and I wanted to be part of it.
Mm.
And it is gendered as well, because women are intentionally excluded from war. War doesn't work if women are part of it. So, and it's actually very hard to get people to go to war, to force human beings to the point that they're killing each other. Is not an easy thing to do, and it doesn't come naturally.
No.
And excluding women from it is one of the only ways you can make them do that.
Right, interesting. Yeah, yeah. You have to sort of, you know, kind of brutalize the men who have to, you know, if you have to go and kill someone for a living, which is essentially what a, you know, frontline soldier's job is, you know, there's a certain process you have to go through in order to be able to do that.
Mm.
And I can see how the sort of softening influence of a woman's
It's just balance. Presence. It's not that women are softer. It's just balance. You're creating an environment where you're taking away half of the population. And so that affects war photography as well, I think. And so this is about my relationship with masculinity and...
Yeah. I mean, has
my gender.
Your interest in trying to figure some of this stuff out has kind of taken you into an academic setting in a way. Is that is that why? Because you're doing this Nyman Fellowship, and I think you've been working on a book or something. Tell me a little bit about what you're working on and what your kind of what issues you're sort of trying to look into.
Mm-hmm. So I spent a year at Harvard on the Nyman Journalism Fellowship researching essentially like the way we tell stories about war and thinking about the way we tell stories about contemporary conflict and the way we've always told stories about the war and what that means, like the storytelling of these experiences. And I also took writing classes, fiction and narrative nonfiction. And then I stayed in the States and was a fellow at the Carey Institute for Global Good. And there I started working on a book about photography and war and the representation of violence and what that means, a narrative nonfiction book. So I've been writing up there in upstate New York for 7 months. And now I'm still working through the book proposal. Mm.
Oh, great. Okay, so that's a work in progress, as it were.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So back to the, you know, for photography, I suppose. I mean, I don't really care whether I'm going out of chronological sequence, because it doesn't really matter. I'm probably jumping around a bit, but well, let's talk about your experiences in sort of Russia and Ukraine, because I think you spent a fair chunk of your time in those regions, you know, on various different stories. What took you to that part of the world initially?
I was living in Syria when I first worked, visited Russia. So I lived in Syria for a year and then Lebanon for a year and a half. And I first went to Russia to photograph young women in Cossack cadet academies. And I went because of one of my dear friends, Kamila Naprus, who I had met by photographing her, had grown up in the circus, and she'd met real Cossacks, real Russian Cossacks, and she told me about them. And she said to me one day, while we were having dinner, you should go and photograph the Cossacks in Russia. I can't go because she's a horse master and a stunt woman, but she said, you can, because you're a photographer, you should go and check it out. And so I did. I always take her advice when it comes to project ideas.
Well, so you're saying it was like you were missing horses from your kind of childhood experience, having those around, so it was...
Yeah, I was just being, you know, especially when it comes to your own work, like you get to choose, right, where you want to go and who you want to be with and what you want to experience. And I can tell you that, and I do make photographs for a whole host of different reasons, but one of them is also because this is the life that I've chosen for myself, and it's beyond a job or a career, and it's how I want to live and experience the world, and so I get to choose who I meet.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I really liked working in that part of the world because I have a Russian name and everyone can pronounce it, and when I'm in Ukraine and I go into the shop to buy vegetables, people speak to me in Russian or Ukrainian because I look like I'm from there too. So I feel really at home. I feel really at home. That's just, and the more time you spend somewhere, you know, you make friends and you develop a relationship with the place and people. So I feel at home in London, but I also feel really at home in Kiev and in Beirut too. Lots of places to call home.
Yeah. Then you did the supermodel, Siberian supermodel story, which is a really lovely set of pictures. And how did you come by that? Where did the idea for that first kind of...
That was Camilla's idea as well.
Uh-huh.
She phoned me one day and she was like...
She's useful, isn't she?
She is. She phoned me. I was living... I think I was in Beirut at that time. Yeah, she phoned me and said, I've just seen an episode of Jonathan Ross... And Natalia Vodianova, she's a famous supermodel, was on there talking about this one town in Siberia that's full of beautiful women because of all these model agencies. And I was like, what? And she's like, I don't know, I just think it would be an amazing photo project. But I can't remember the name of the town. And eventually Camilla found the clip on YouTube and she kept watching it again and again and again to try and get the name of the town, but couldn't quite catch it. But we had a rough idea and it was Novosibirsk, which is the capital of Siberia. So I started Googling modeling agencies in this town and eventually traveled a portion of the Trans-Siberian Railway with some international model scouts who were looking for girls. Where in small towns and cities where local model agencies held castings. So yeah, that was Camilla's idea.
Yeah.
And actually, we're making a book together now. That's where I have to go this afternoon with Stuart Smith, who made my Maidan book, the designer.
Yeah.
We're making a book about Camilla's business and her horses and her carriage collection, which is one of the largest in the world.
Wow.
So yeah, finally her and I get to actually work together on a project. She's been kind of I worked all summer for her and she was kind of like art directing this giant studio where we photographed all these amazing famous horses from the movies and their carriages. I photographed almost 600 carriages in a giant studio.
Wow.
It took a month.
Wow. She sounds like an interesting character. And so these girls, I mean, essentially, I mean, I guess, you know, they're sort of looking for a passport out of a kind of, you know, small town existence, I suppose, to some extent. And I guess you could relate to that desire to, you know, escape in a way. Mm-hmm. Was that something that, you know, kind of struck you immediately when you started meeting them?
Well, just when you're a teenager, we talked a bit about teenage girls already, mm. you know, just the sense of like knowing that something's out there, not knowing what it is or how to get there, but knowing that there's something out there and you want a piece of it and you want to see it and you want to be part of the rest of the world. You know, that leaving the nest and
yeah, of course, yeah,
discovering the world for yourself on your own. So,
but I imagine for the most part, it isn't going to happen for a lot of them or for most of them. I don't know.
It's a bit like photojournalism, yeah. isn't it?
I think one of them made it to the
big
time.
A couple of the girls, yeah. I photographed, yeah.
Have you kept in touch with any of them? Oh, that's great.
Yeah, through social media. It's easy to keep in touch with people these days, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, totally. All you got to do is friend them on Facebook.
Yeah.
You don't have to make any real effort. You know, you don't have to sit down and write a letter like you used to have to and put a stamp on the envelope.
No.
Not that that's a great effort, but it's a hell of a lot more so than...
No, Olga, the main protagonist of that story, was 14 or 15 when I photographed her. She came to London a few years later and visited me while she was here. She was modeling and she lives in LA now. So I see her on Instagram almost every day.
Great. So let's talk about the Maidan Square project, which was obviously during the, I don't know what the correct term would be, the uprising or the
revolution.
The revolution, I suppose, yeah, is a good word as any. During the revolution in Kiev, in Ukraine, Maidan Square was the sort of focal point for it. And I guess you went, you know, in the name of photojournalism, and did you have an idea of, you know, what you wanted to do or how you wanted to shoot it? Because I think, you know, it seems to me you're one of those people who thinks a lot about, you know, trying to move away from the kind of established conventions in a way, and that is what you ended up doing. But, you know, what were your thoughts on initially going there?
Well, I was working on another project called Negative Zero that was looking at population decline in Europe, and so Ukraine has the lowest life expectancy for men in Europe, even before the recent conflict. So I had this, and more people die in the winter. More babies are born in the spring, more people die in the winter. So I was going to Ukraine to photograph why men were dying too soon in the winter. And of all of Ukraine, the lowest life expectancy was in the eastern Donbass region. So while I was getting permission from the Ministry of Health to get access to TB dispensaries and maybe the prison and various other places in the east, I was in Kiev and began visiting Maidan Square and the protests there together with my colleagues, the other photojournalists who were covering it. But it wasn't my intention to make a project about what was happening there. But then I spent some days and I didn't want to leave and I kept delaying my trip. And I just felt it was a place I wanted to be, but I couldn't figure out what purpose there would be in me covering what was happening there, since so many people were already doing that. So I just had to, I was searching for a way to... I'm searching for my way to make my pictures about what was happening in Ukraine and to think about them as like a small contribution to the visual documentation of that time, the collective visual documentation, because this was a very well photographed event. And so that's why eventually I settled on portraiture in a makeshift studio.
Mm. I think one of the things that was interesting about it is that it was an idea that occurred to you previously. I think you were in Syria and
in Libya. I was in Libya.
And it was something which I think you probably felt was a failure overall this trip or this attempt to cover that story. So just before we talk about the Maidan Square, I'd love to hear about how, you know, when that idea initially came to you. Because I think it's a good example of how, you know, what can sometimes seem like a failure can, you know, can sometimes bear fruit further down the road, you know, that you're not really anticipating happening.
I have failed lots and lots of times, and I know I will again.
Of course, well. And that's the other lesson, isn't it? That, you know, it's incredibly important to learn that failure is part of the equation all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It sucks, but it is. Yeah, I just had this thought because I was interested in the way people were dressing themselves in Libya and the way the rebels there were kind of emulating the dress of Hollywood rebels and the way photojournalists, myself included, were also emulating the costumes of those rebels. So just thinking about how we present ourselves in those situations.
Mm.
And I thought it would be really interesting to make a series of portraits before people went out to the front line each morning of the rebels and the journalists.
Right.
And to look at them together. It was, you know, a flash of a thought across my mind enough to tell my friends about it. But I wasn't a portrait photographer. I still don't think I am, really. And when I was in Maidan, I was reminded of this again, the costumes, the way we choose to dress ourselves, the way we looked like the protesters did, and the way we held ourselves and brandished our cameras in the same way that they held their weapons. So I started photographing protesters, but also civilians who are visiting and also journalists. I have a series of portraits of photojournalists in my studio. It didn't become part of the book in the end, but that was like the start of the idea that I would photograph us and them and wonder about what the difference was.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And yeah. Eventually my project became portraits of the protesters and then of the women who came to mourn them and lay flowers after everyone had been killed. But it was, you know, it was just like the spark of an idea that led to another, that led to another, that led to another.
Yeah. And when the women with the flowers started showing up, I don't know if that was something, you know, you could have anticipated, but that was that a moment where you realized that kind of, in a way it made the project, it gave it another depth, and it seems to me made it complete, as it were. What were your feelings at the time as far as, you know, the women and you know, do you remember thinking this is kind of really making it more interesting?
I didn't plan anything. No. I didn't really plan to make a project in Maidan. I didn't plan to abandon my other project, Negative Zero, in favor of making it. I didn't plan to be a portrait photographer. I didn't plan to photograph the men, really, let alone the women. But the first morning, women began arriving. Emine Ziyadinova, who's a Ukrainian photojournalist and journalist, who was working with me on this project, her and I just looked at each other and kind of intuitively knew that we should stop women and try and photograph them in the same way. And we were stood out every day for hours in the freezing cold, chain smoking, and considering what we were doing. So it was really as a result of those conversations. And so we just started stopping women in exactly the same way, but it wasn't really planned. And it was as a result of this relationship between us and this kind of engagement with the project. No, I didn't know what was going to happen.
I like the way you were sort of photographing down, you know, through your viewfinder in a way. I don't know I think you used your iPhone or something. That was a brilliant idea. How did that come to you, the idea of doing that?
I started thinking about how I saw the world, and if I was going to engage with social media, I shouldn't just put the pictures there that would end up in a book or in a magazine or in an exhibition. I should try and add another layer to, you know, show something else. So I thought maybe I could use social media as a means to show how I see the world. And I don't see the world like one of my photographs. In order to see that scene like that, I would have to put down my photograph and just stand there and look at it.
Mm.
And I don't do that. I see everything like 6x6 centimeters reversed mirror image through a ground glass that's covered in dust.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a nice insight into just how shit things can look when you're looking through that thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have the vision to realize that actually it's going to, you know, the final thing. Yeah. I love the way the, you know, the background is really black, you know, really incredibly black, and it just all looks perfect. But you weren't necessarily planning a book. In fact, I think it was Larry Tell who said, this would be a book. He, you know, you can't ignore a recommendation from him, can you really? or a suggestion from him.
I dismissed it immediately, but it somehow planted the thought in my mind, yeah. You know, and then when I was shooting, I had that in mind.
So you were thinking of it more as a sort of magazine spread or something, were you? Or you weren't even thinking that? Because it seems to be an obvious, not even, right.
Well, because I was shooting film and it was a breaking news story in the end.
Right.
So,
but you knew you were taking a more considered and a slower approach in a way. So it's the sort of thing that might end up as a, you know, a nice spread in the New York Times or whatever, I suppose. But it did make a good book in the end, a great book in the end, I think.
Thank you.
Well, it's been great to talk to you, and I appreciate you making the time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you, Anastasia. Lovely to meet you.